Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It seems somehow ironic on this Independence Day for all those politicians who were pushing the credit rating agencies to become more independent. They might now be regretting they got what they wished for when it comes to Greece. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, happy July 4th, 2011. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal, who I'm guessing is enjoying the family and something on the barbecue right about now. In the meantime, Greece, it seems, has gone from the frying pan back into the fire. It felt like the financial heat had come down a notch. Last week, the Greek parliament approved an austerity package and won another chunk of bailout money. But today, the ratings agency Standard & Poor's effectively declared you can't cool things off just by breaking the thermometer. Here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
Just when Greece began to breathe a little more easily, S&P has put the boot in. The rating agency has criticized one part of the rescue package, a bond refinancing plan. Under the proposal, some holders of Greek government debt would delay cashing in their bonds. The architects of the plan call it reprofiling. S&P calls it something else altogether. Here's Julian Pendock of Senhouse Capital Investment Fund.
You can call it a reprofiling, you can call it a restructuring, you can call it whatever you want. But in fact, technically, they are saying it counts as a default, which could open a can of worms.
S&P says the reprofiling is just a default in disguise because investors will get less value than they were originally promised. If Greece does default, Greek banks could collapse and many other dominoes might quickly fall. Greece does have a bit of time before it has to resolve this latest issue, but not much. The deadline for its next debt repayment is in September. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Now on to our own debt dilemma. This week, congressional leaders will be hauled back from their vacations for a special session to resolve the debt ceiling stalemate. The hard deadline to raise the borrowing limit is August 4th. Republican John McCain said yesterday he might be open to raising some government revenue, but he didn't offer specifics. The give and take over spending cuts versus increasing revenue is fraying some nerves among the GOP rank and file, and as Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports, among investors as well.
At the July 4th Tea Party rally this afternoon on Independence Mall, there were more people sporting balloon animal hats than political protest signs. It felt like a big picnic, but unlike perhaps most picnics today, everyone here seemed ready and eager to talk about the $12 trillion U.S. debt ceiling.
No debt increase, no. Why keep spending on things that aren't necessary to spend on?
I certainly wouldn't approve an increase in the debt ceiling.
No?
I think we need to experience the pain to straighten everything out.
That economic pain could start sooner than the August 4th deadline. Markets have been quiet up till now as investors expect a political compromise. But Greg McBride with Bankrate.com says that could change.
As time gets shorter, if we're not seeing that progress is being made, investors are going to grow increasingly nervous, and that's going to be a recipe for heightened volatility in financial markets.
Adnan Akant manages the currency market for Fisher Francis Trees & Watts in New York. He says if the standoff drags on to late July, that volatility in the stock market will start spilling over into the economy as a whole.
Businessmen will stop planning to hire people. Interest rates might actually rise. And I think that economic conditions will weaken.
And he says if there's no deal by the August 4th deadline, the economy could fall off the wall. Like Humpty Dumpty, he says, it would be impossible to put the pieces back together again. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Europe's reaction to those renewed debt doubts about Greece when we do the numbers. Ah, the freedom to choose. It's one of our most prized liberties, especially choosing what we eat. Of course, it helps to know what we're eating.
Tomorrow is the last day the public can weigh in, so to speak, on new rules proposed by the Food and Drug Administration. They'd require that calorie counts be posted by chain restaurants nationwide. Imagine knowing how your meal really stacks up at Taco Bell or Applebee's. Similar laws are already in force in New York City, Seattle, and across California, and that's giving us an idea how this might affect our habits. Nicholas Bagley teaches health law at the University of Michigan Law School. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Now, you've pointed to research that suggests that once restaurants begin posting calorie counts, very little will really change?
That's right. We know because New York City has tried. Since 2008, chain restaurants in the city have had to post calorie count information. And so researchers compared the food choices that low-income children and adults made in neighboring Newark, which doesn't require the posting of calorie counts, with low-income children and adults in New York City. And they found that calorie counts had virtually no effect on what New Yorkers actually purchased.
Why?
Well, nobody's exactly sure. At the outset, some people, kids especially, just don't pay any attention to calorie counts. And for those who do see them and do register that they're there, calorie counts can be deceptively hard to use. People may know that they shouldn't eat too many calories, for example, but they may not know how many are too many. And for most people, the choice of what to eat is really driven by taste and cost, not calorie counts.
So you're suggesting that maybe we need to post these calorie counts with flashing red lights for the worst ones, or what?
People are attracted in our culture to these informational solutions, to the idea that if we give people the right information, surely they're going to make better decisions. But there's been a ton of research in public policy circles on these sorts of informational solutions, and it turns out that no matter how much information you give people, they still tend to make pretty poor choices, pretty consistently.
One of the other questions that's occurred to me is, how are we even sure that these calorie counts that are being posted are accurate?
We can't be sure that the calorie counts are accurate. In 2010, researchers at Tufts actually looked into the calories at restaurant food. And they found that the restaurant food contained, on average, about 18% more calories than advertised, with some items having as many as twice as many calories.
This all focuses on the consumer's reaction to all this, though. If the restaurants are indeed changing their menus and modifying certain items to reduce calories and sodium content or whatever, isn't that a positive step that's going to have some effect on what consumers do?
Well, it's a positive step, but it's too early to tell whether it's just smart marketing. Chain restaurants, and especially fast food joints, have an image problem. People think that they're big contributors to the obesity epidemic. If fixing up a few of their menu items can improve that image and help keep the regulators off their back, that's good for their bottom line. But it remains to be seen whether the restaurants actually make a full-throated commitment to cut the calories for their most popular food items. I have to admit, I'm a little skeptical.
Well, if that's true, what would have an effect?
Well, combating obesity requires a mammoth social commitment. Posting calorie counts just doesn't cut it. We don't need people to eat better in restaurants. We got to get them out of those restaurants and into their kitchens. And perhaps most challenging of all, we've just got to change people's attitudes about food.
Nicholas Bagley is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Thanks for burning a few calories with us.
Happy to do it.
Fewer Americans were expected to drive this Independence Day weekend than last. Blame higher gas prices. But the number of holiday travelers flying is estimated to be up by 9% to 3 million. Never mind an 11% rise in airfares. If it's any consolation, the airlines aren't always taking more without giving back something in return. Take Delta Airlines. It's launched a web feature that lets you keep tabs on your luggage every moment it's out of your hands. Gigi Dubin reports from Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, it's jarring and it's loud. But you know what? After a long flight, that sound at the airport baggage carousel is music to a traveler's ears. It was for Eric Klein, who just got off flights from Las Vegas to Memphis to Birmingham. We're at the baggage carousel.
So what are we looking for?
Just a regular, like, gym bag type of wheels, suitcase.
Klein has never lost luggage, so he's a glass-half-full kind of guy when it comes to these things. Until the baggage carousel suddenly stops.
It's not good.
And then there's that moment of dread we've all felt. Did your bags make it? Delta Airlines wants you to know earlier whether they have. The company recently launched an online tracking system, so you can follow your bags during your trip, just like you would a package through UPS or FedEx. Morgan Durant is a spokesman for Delta.
What this does is gives customers visibility into what's going on with their checked bags.
Here's how it works. You go to Delta.com, enter your last name and baggage receipt number, and you get updates on your bags, even during your flight, if you happen to have Wi-Fi on board.
For example, you'll be able to see when the bag is scanned plane side or just as it's being loaded onto an aircraft.
Now, this much bag tracking might seem a little overkill, sort of like that friend who posts hourly updates on Facebook. But Durant says it comes in handy when luggage is lost. Still bad news, but at least you find out sooner.
That's better from our point of view to know that sooner rather than go to a carousel and not have a bag show up, so then you've burned time that you didn't have to burn.
And Delta employees spend less time fielding questions on the whereabouts of a passenger's luggage. That frees staff and gets people in and out of the airport quickly. But it can also mean bigger profits for Delta, says Morningstar analyst Paul Swinand.
Better experience, but ultimately if they can figure out how to improve the overall process, that would impact the bottom line.
But don't expect to see more people checking bags. Yes, there will always be that family of five that can't cram everything into a carry-on. But frequent flyers and business travelers won't necessarily check bags just because they can keep tabs on them. For passengers like Eric Klein, the only thing likely to make him check a bag is if the airline lopped off the fee for checking bags. Oh, and update. After 10 minutes, Klein's bag did emerge.
So there's my bag right there.
In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, why some fly fishermen aren't happy with a new trend in looking fly.
It's blown up because now, you know, Steven Tyler on American Idol's got bushels of feathers.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was off today, but that S&P warning about Greece we told you about left European markets mixed. The German DAX and British FTSE indices each rose by at least a third of a percent, but the French CAC 40 dipped one-tenth of a percent. Earlier in the day, the Japanese Nikkei index topped the 10,000 mark for the first time since early May. In the aftermath of the quake and tsunami there, it closed 1% higher. Elsewhere in Asia, the Shanghai Composite Index added nearly 2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the 5th of July. The Commerce Department releases factory orders for May. It's Independence Day for Venezuela. The country declared freedom from Spain 200 years ago. And it'll be 15 years ago that Dolly the Sheep was born in Scotland. She was the first mammal cloned from an adult cell. I'm Avishai Artsy.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moonen for Kai Rizdahl. Over the next several weeks, a few million Americans will grab their lawn chairs, the ones with the built-in beer can holders, and head out to a summer music festival. Here in California this weekend, we had the High Sierra Festival. New Orleans had its Essence Festival. In Milwaukee, it was Summerfest. As Mitchell Hartman reports from this weekend's Waterfront Blues Festival in Portland, Oregon, after a few dismal years, things are looking up for artists and concert promoters. For you,
and I sing them just for me. Portland hosts one of the biggest blues festivals of the summer. 100,000 people, acts like Robert Cray, Lucinda Williams, and Buddy Guy. Some summer music events died in the recession, like the Mile High Festival in Denver and Live Nation's Pemberton Festival in British Columbia. The ones that survived are stronger, says Peter Damon, who books artists for the Portland Festival, a nonprofit benefiting the Oregon Food Bank.
Most of these touring acts really look at festivals to pay their way. A lot of the connecting dots on these tours have disappeared over the last couple of years. For the mid-level acts that are playing clubs, a lot of those clubs don't exist anymore.
Last summer, some top pop stars got burned. They didn't fill giant concert venues, and they left tickets on the table, says Gary Bongiovanni of the concert industry trade publication Polestar.
Business is considerably better than it was a year ago at this time.
Bongiovanni says that's partly the economy reviving and fans willing to splurge on a concert or festival instead of a big summer vacation. And it's also smarter ticket pricing.
Many of the artists have put in lower price points rather than waiting for the public to say, I'm not going to spend $50 for the lousy seats. I'm going to go ahead and price them at $20 or $30.
Seems like even for a memorable summer music experience, Americans will still always look for a discount. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You might find this hard to believe, but consider it my own Declaration of Independence. I live here in Southern California, and I do not own a car. I do rent one occasionally. Okay, frequently. Too bad I don't have access to a budding business up north in the San Francisco Bay Area. Three companies there are matching cars that sit unused with people who can use them. It's called car sharing. So people like me, who occasionally need a car, can take the neighbor's Ferrari out for a spin. That got KALW's Casey Miner wondering, why would people share their cars?
My car is a fun car. It's a big jacked-up Jeep and it's got oversized tires. The top comes off and it's a fun car.
Allie Fenn lives in San Francisco, and she'd be happy to let you borrow her Jeep, even though she's probably never met you.
I had the first rental within a week. It was slightly awkward. The person came up and said, you know, how does this work? What do I do? I said, I guess I just give you my key and you drive away. I mean, it was very easy.
Fenn drives her Jeep maybe once a month. The rest of the time, it just sits in her garage. A few months ago, she found out about a new company called Getaround, located just down the street from her. She registered her Jeep on Getaround's website, set up a calendar to show when it was available, and named her price.
I charge $15 an hour or $50 for a day.
Renters pay for gas, and the company provides comprehensive insurance, so the car is totally covered.
It was gone for 24 hours, and it was gone overnight, and I walked down through my garage to go somewhere else, and my car wasn't there, and I thought, I have no idea where my car is at this moment.
Jessica Scorpio is one of the founders of Getaround. She says people who car share don't think of their cars as their babies. They just see them as tools, so they're not overly attached.
You know, it takes a certain type of open-minded person to decide they want to share their car.
We're not talking cheap clunkers here. You can rent anything from late 90s sedans to a brand new Tesla Roadster. The idea is for car owners to make money. That Tesla will run you $50 an hour.
We've got a number of Priuses. We've got a bunch of SUVs a truck, a big cargo van.
Shelby Clark is the founder of Relay Rides, another car share company in the city. His goal is for people to be able to find the kind of car they need when they need it.
People are becoming more and more comfortable with sharing. But at the same time, people don't really want to compromise on their lifestyle. I think that sharing goods is a really great way to do that.
Right now, a few thousand people are car sharing in the Bay Area. But will this work for those of us who don't have fancy rides? I decided to find out by signing up my own car, a 1998 Honda Civic. Dark green and awesome. I picked Getaround because they have cars and renters in my neighborhood. Jessica Scorpio met me at Getaround's offices in San Francisco to take a look.
I'd say this is probably on the old beat-up spectrum, to put it kind of bluntly, I guess.
Okay, so my car does have more than 100,000 miles on it, and one of the doors doesn't open, and there's no radio. But it runs just fine. Surely I could persuade someone to rent it. I sat down with Scorpio to create my car's online profile.
Check off what features your car has.
I do have air conditioning. Let's see. Nope, I think that might be the only feature that my car has.
Given that, I set my hourly rate to the minimum, just $3 an hour. But a few days went by and no one was biting. I started to worry that my car just wasn't good enough. Then, finally, I got a request.
Chris Brooks, I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Brooks told me he came to California more or less on a whim. The mood just struck him one day.
Here I am.
You know, have a good time this week.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for letting me use your car.
Brooks returned my trusty Honda Civic a few days later in pristine condition. He filled up the gas, even made me a new set of keys. It was nice to have my car back, but in the end, I'm just as well off without it. If I really need to drive somewhere, I can always rent someone else's car. In San Francisco, I'm Casey Miner for Marketplace.
It's been a tough weekend for businesses that depend on recreation in the Northern Rockies. Dangerous high water conditions have caused a lot of trip cancellations just when the whitewater rafting and fly fishing seasons are supposed to be getting underway. And it seems that's not the only challenge facing fly fishermen these days. For years, they've used rooster feathers, pricey ones at that, to make the intricate lures that get the fish to bite. And as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, there is some new competition for all that plumage.
Gabrielle Aquaro has worked in Southern California hair salons for 15 years, so she's always on the lookout for the latest trend. About 6 months ago,
I saw these feather pieces in this girl's hair. She had some wild, curly hair, and I thought, that looks really cool. What is that?
So she mentioned the feathers to her dad.
He says, I've got just the thing for you, kid. Come on over.
Well, I thought it was a great idea, and I had my fly tying equipment in the garage just gathering dust.
In his kit, Ted Aquaro had a stash of long, thin feathers. Gabrielle bundled them a few at a time and layered them into her client's hair for $25 a pop.
And are you happy with that placement?
Yes. No, I love it.
Other stylists have also discovered the trend.
And now it's blown up because now, you know, Steven Tyler on American Idol's got bushels of feathers.
And Hilary Duff and Miley Cyrus.
Everybody's into it.
Which is fine for Steve Ellis, owner of a fly shop in Southern California. He supplies Aquaro's feathers and says business has been booming.
Oh, we love it. We'd like to see all these cute girls come in and we have a good time with. We're all those old crotchety guys in here and we just love it.
But some of his customers don't, like this guy, Rich Peters.
Are you a fisherman?
No, I just tie flies.
He's a fisherman who's not very good at it.
Well, I can't tie him anymore because I can't get any feathers. These guys don't have any feathers.
Oh, stop.
Thing is, it's kind of true. Fly shops across the country have been selling out of feathers. And the problem goes back to one farm.
I'm Tom Whiting. I'm the owner and founder of Whiting Farms, where we grow the feathers for the fly tying world.
7 out of 10 top fly feathers are Whiting feathers.
Which also are used now in the fashion world.
Whiting is a geneticist in western Colorado. He raises roosters, about 65,000 at a time. As much as a third of his sales now go to fashion.
We have orders far in excess of what we have in our system.
For years, Whiting was looking for that kind of success. He sold feathers to craft stores, makers of Hawaiian leis, even Vegas showgirls. But he's never seen demand like this. He raised prices on pelts of the popular feathers about 40%. But even that hasn't slowed sales.
They were going on eBay for $100 to $150 a piece when the suggested retail price was like $36.
Whiting says it takes more than a year to boost production. In the meantime, he's reluctant to raise prices too much.
Because when this fad sort of runs its course, my core business is fly tying feathers, whom I don't think they will pay those type of fashion prices. And I would be sort of shooting myself in the foot.
Gabrielle Aquaro doesn't see the fad running its course anytime soon.
You know, we were joking around that Whiting Farms is waiting for their roosters to die because the minute that sucker's dead, they're on him.
The question is, who gets the feathers? Fly fishermen or their daughters? I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, it seems appropriate to raise a toast, given this is a day for celebrating. So let's join the Dinner Party Download crew for a special holiday installment hosted by our own Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and members of the Marketplace staff.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report, what story are you going to be talking about on this 4th of July?
I'm actually going to be tweeting with Ashton Kutcher.
You're not. Really?
I'll tweet to him. He has 7 million followers, greater than the population of Ireland. But because he has so many followers, the LAPD is relying on him to get out public service announcements.
What do they want him to tweet?
Well, if you're in LA, you've certainly heard about it. They're calling it Carmageddon. They're shutting down one of the busiest freeways in the country for a whole weekend. And they're asking Twitter celebrities to get out to their followers to not drive that weekend.
And they couldn't just, like, get the mayor to talk on television about it?
They may be doing all that, but they asked Ashton Kutcher and Lady Gaga and a lot of others to tweet about it. Ashton Kutcher did, but he also wanted the LAPD to forgive him for a traffic violation. He said it was a yellow light.
Rod Abid, senior producer of Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about?
Well, it's Malaysia Airlines, which is defending its brand new policy of banning babies from first class.
Wait a second. Don't babies make up most of first class?
Yeah, but these are the tiny ones, not the tall ones in Armani suits.
Oh, I see. So what happens with rich people with kids? What are they going
to
do?
Well, I got a feeling that I get to babysit the kid when the mother stays in first class.
That's right. The first class ticket will come with an extra ticket for the nanny and coach.
Exactly. The au pair, please.
John Haas, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this 4th of July?
2 weekends ago, somebody took $400 out of an ATM in the Hamptons.
So?
Well, whoever it was left behind their ATM receipt, and it got picked up by a bunch of blogs and websites. And it turns out he has in his savings account $99,864,731. And he had to pay the $250 ATM fee.
Of course. No one's outside the long arm of bank fees. I'm surprised he allowed his account to dip down below $100 million. I think banks in East Hampton will bang you $10 a month for that.
That's how they get you.
There's more where that came from on a podcast Rico and Brendan call The Dinner Party Download, available at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today because of the July 4th holiday. They'll reopen tomorrow. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time, a new way of figuring the cost of running the Internet.
We no longer charge for space. We charge for power.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.